Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Nicaragua is home to the second largest rainforest in the Americas after the Amazon. Nicaragua's forests could be gone in just a few decades if deforestation continues at current rates. This is according to an 8-month investigation by the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. The investigative team reports that deforestation has surged since 2014 when fourth-term President Daniel Ortega took direct control of Nicaragua's National Forestry Agency as part of a broad power grab that cemented his personal control over the impoverished country. Nicaragua's environmental disaster is not getting the attention it deserves because its witnesses are being silenced, according to the report. Last year, Nicaragua was the deadliest country in the world per capita for people who defend their land and the environment, according to Global Witness. Killings of Nicaraguans defending their land more than doubled in 2020 compared to the previous year. And media outlets faced a never-ending series of criminal charges. Reporters working with the project fled the country one after another. Joining us to discuss Nicaragua's forgotten deforestation crisis is Sasha Chavkin, an investigative reporter specializing in the environment, Latin America, and public corruption. He was the lead reporter for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project's investigation. He is a Rainforest Investigations Network fellow covering deforestation for NBC News and the Pulitzer Center. Hi, Sasha. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this was an incredible and devastating investigation. Given that this is not getting that much attention, thanks to your investigation, it is now. How did you all come to learn what was happening in Nicaragua?
This project began with a leak that the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP, obtained, which had more than 18,000 internal documents from Nicaragua's forestry ministry, which is called INAFOR. And what those emails and memos and other government materials showed for the first time was they gave a direct look at how Nicaragua's government and the first family of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega and his wife, Rosario Murillo, who's also the vice president, directly controlled the forestry ministry and how that corrupt system was fueling this environmental disaster that you've just described.
And just to give people a little bit of information about Ortega, in January, he was sworn in for the fourth straight term. And as you mentioned, his wife is vice president. She was sworn in for her second term. You all report that Ortega and his family are very, obviously Ortega, but his family also is very influential. In fact, you quoted Ryan Berg, a senior fellow in the Americas program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who said that Ortega and Murillo have used their, quote, army of nine children to ensure the family has control over key sectors of the economy. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, it's this very strange, alarming arrangement where you have the president, his wife is the vice president, and then they have nine children who have various positions of control over companies that either receive contracts from the state or sometimes are state companies themselves. Several of Ortega's children, as well as Ortega and Murillo themselves, have been sanctioned by the United States, not only for cracking down on democracy, but also for corruption and for personally profiting from looting Nicaragua's government for their own benefit. And part of what we saw in this investigation is that that kind of behavior is what is driving the world-leading deforestation rates that are occurring within Nicaragua. You see companies that have funneled money to the first family and to Rosario Murillo and Ortega's children. getting huge amounts of unexplained permits to cut down forest from the Nicaraguan government. And it really shows this larger issue that I think deserves a lot more attention, which is how much of a crucial role that corruption plays in driving environmental damage and deforestation. You know, I think that a lot of the discussion about deforestation looks at, you know, whether companies are being given permits to exploit land, or whether there are situations where natural resources aren't being protected as fully as they should. But a big part of what's driving these kinds of environmental disasters in Nicaragua, but also beyond, is state corruption and the kind of kleptocracy that we see in Nicaragua.
Let's talk about some of that corruption. The INAFOR data shows that First Lady Rosario Murillo, who again is vice president, and other public officials intervened directly in the agency's work, using it to hand out favors to politically connected companies. So tell us more about what you found specifically around corruption.
So there were a number of case studies that we looked into. One that really stood out to me was about a member of Congress named Osorno Coleman, who's the Congress member who represents the indigenous territory in Nicaragua's north. And that's an area that's supposed to be under legal control of indigenous communities. And it's also an area that's mostly forests and has been suffering some of the worst rates of deforestation in the country. This Congress member, Osorno Coleman, used to be a member of the Contras. This was the army that was backed by the CIA and fought against Daniel Ortega during Nicaragua's civil war in the 1980s. This was someone who spent his whole life as an enemy of Daniel Ortega. What we found is that a few years ago, Coleman, after spending his life fighting against the government, suddenly inexplicably joined into this political alliance with Ortega, in which he joined the Sandinista Alliance in Congress, and was elected to represent the northern Nicaraguan indigenous region. What our investigation found is that Coleman secretly had shares in a forestry company in that area, and the top members of the government, including Rosario Murillo and the Speaker of the National Assembly, did political favors for this forestry company, like giving it permits to cut down more forests than its quota had allowed, or to export more pine resin than its forests had allowed, And that behavior illustrated how the Ortega regime has gained so much control and influence over Nicaragua's indigenous territories, where the forests are supposed to be protected, but instead what's happening is that there's more and more forestry exploitation and more destruction of those forests.
This is really an incredible story. Why did he flip? What did you find?
So, again, what we saw is that after a career where this man literally spent his life in the trenches fighting against Ortega and the Sandinistas, in 2016, he ran for Congress and flipped and became one of Ortega's allies. And what we found is that at the time, he secretly had a 10% stake in a forestry company called Vita Group, and may have been illegally profiting from the company's work on indigenous territories. We saw that as he was promoting Vita Group in the Miskito community, that's the indigenous group that he belonged to, urging his fellow Miskito to work for this company, the government was doing favors like giving the company permits beyond what its quotas had allowed, and the top members of the government were overriding ordinary INAFOR procedures to make sure that this company was succeeding and was making money and was being allowed to export all of this pine resin, which is what it was producing. Now, Coleman said he was doing this to help the community and to provide jobs for people. But as a congressman, he's not allowed to have shares in a company that benefits from doing business with the state. And Vita Group got permits from the state. It depended on the state in order to allow it to conduct its business of exporting pine resin. And experts told us that that was a violation of the law and that what Coleman was doing was not legal.
You report that workers say Vita Group pays them barely enough to survive for collecting resin, which is then shipped abroad at more than double the price. Felix Osenes, who collects resin to sell to Vita Group, says, quote, "From our perspective, as Indigenous people, we value Coleman as a leader, but for his part, he does not take us into account. To him, we are nothing."
Yeah, we had a very brave Nicaraguan reporter on our team, Christopher Mendoza, who traveled up to the Northern Indigenous Territory in Nicaragua to report on those communities and how they were affected by Vita Group. And what his reporting showed was that community members felt like they were being exploited. As you described, they were paid a fraction of what the community, of what the company was making for exporting this pine resin. There were a variety of social issues that accompanied the company's entrance into communities, including at times the police were mobilized to crack down on community leaders, Indigenous leaders, who didn't want the company to be working in their communities. So again, this was a company that Coleman described as an effort to bring jobs, to fight poverty, to bring prosperity to his community. But what our reporting showed is that community members were paid a fraction of what the company was making, and all kinds of social discord and environmental damage was resulting from its activities.
What is pine resin used for?
So pine resin is used for things like turpentine and other products that I guess are used in paint, in other household products. This company, particularly Vita Group, was exporting its pine resin to Vietnam, to a Vietnamese company that was then in turn selling it to others. Nicaragua has these huge pine forests in the north of the country, which are an incredibly important ecosystem, but which are one of the areas that has been most affected by deforestation and by environmental damage. And this pine resin company, although it wasn't cutting down the trees, members of the community described the trees as drying up, and of being damaged by over-exploitation, in which the company would repeatedly take more resin from more trees than could sustainably be harvested.
Today, we are speaking with Sasha Chavkin, an investigative reporter specializing in the environment, Latin America, and public corruption. He was the lead reporter for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project's investigation. It's called Nicaragua's Forgotten Deforestation Crisis. And you can read the piece at yourcallradio.org. It's complete with graphics and maps. Sasha Chavkin is a Rainforest Investigations Network Fellow covering deforestation for NBC News and the Pulitzer Center. If you have any questions for Sasha about this reporting, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Again, Nicaragua is home to the second largest rainforest in the Americas after the Amazon. Nicaragua's forests could be gone in just a few decades if deforestation continues at current rates. Let's talk about a little bit more about what went into the reporting project. You just mentioned Christopher Mendoza, who we'll talk about in a minute. But as you report, sources clammed up and became unreachable in one case after being targeted for assassination. You write that you all struggled to find experts who could clarify points of law or explain the technicalities of forestry permits. The people you tracked down were often too scared to speak, fearful for their own safety and that of their families. So just give us a sense of, you know, what is happening right now in Nicaragua and why it is so dangerous to be an environmental defender.
It was a pretty awful situation. I've done a fair amount of reporting in other countries in Latin America, including in Venezuela, in El Salvador, in Honduras, you know, stories about other countries that have had serious instability and political problems. I've never encountered a climate of fear and repression like what we found in Nicaragua last year. I wasn't able to enter the country to report on the ground because of the situation there. What happened was that Daniel Ortega, who's the authoritarian president of Nicaragua, was up for re-election last year. And about 6 months before the election, he decided that he was going to massively crack down on all political opposition in civil society. There were seven other serious presidential candidates who were opponents. Every single one of them was either arrested or went into exile. Leading journalists were also either exiled or arrested. NGOs have been cracked down on and put out of business. You know, again, it's a model that is not very different from what we see in other autocratic countries like Russia right now. But it's absolutely frightening to see it playing out in real time when you're trying to talk to people to understand what's causing an environmental disaster and everyone is too scared to be able to explain.
Well, let's talk about Christopher Mendoza. Last June, your team hired Christopher to find out how all of this was affecting indigenous communities. He is a Nicaraguan journalist based in Managua, and he managed to reach the remote indigenous communities situated along the Coco River near the northern border with Honduras. As you report, he gathered accounts from Mosquito residents about the toll of environmental destruction and encroachment by outsiders on their lands, as well as the climate of impunity that made these abuses possible. So tell us more about Christopher and what he managed to uncover. I mean, he was one of the lead reporters on the piece we talked about called Nicaraguan Indigenous Leader Who Aligned with Government Reaps Hidden Reward. Tell us just a little bit more about Christopher and how he was able to do this work.
Yeah, Christopher is an outstanding and dedicated journalist. You know, he's Nicaraguan, has lived in Nicaragua all of his life. We at OCCRP, we hired him to travel to northern Nicaragua to report in these communities as part of our piece. And he went there and did a fantastic job. Shortly after he returned to Managua, the capital city, he got summoned by prosecutors in Nicaragua to be interrogated. The interrogation was not about his work on this project, but was about part of a larger crackdown that they were conducting on the media outlet, which he worked for, which was called Onda Local. And based on other people's experiences, he had seen other people who went in for interrogations being sent directly to jail. He decided that he had to flee the country where he had lived and worked his entire life. In you know, just a matter of a few weeks, he fled the country and is now living in exile. You know, still dedicated to reporting on Nicaragua and doing the best he can to bring their story to light, but obviously devastated at the repression that forced him to completely turn his life upside down, you know, in a matter of weeks.
Wow. Wow. He said there was no time to plan anything. I just had to go. He says that now most independent reporting on Nicaragua takes place outside the country via exiled reporters and sources who can speak more freely. But he says every Nicaraguan journalist he knows wants to go back. All the Nicaraguan journalists I know have their backpacks ready to return to keep telling the story of Nicaragua. Do you have any idea how many Nicaraguan journalists have fled at this point?
I couldn't give you a number, but certainly I know several firsthand. And, you know, these are some of the top journalists in the country. What you have in Nicaragua is a situation where the government has decided that it simply will not allow any kind of free press. And that means that journalists who are doing the kind of investigative work that is so essential to holding their government to account are no longer safe in the country. And so what you've seen, and you know, this happens in other dictatorships as well, but now the only people who are willing and able to hold the Nicaraguan government to account are mostly outside of the country and reporting in exile.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about how indigenous communities are affected by all of this. You report that the Basawas Biosphere Reserve, which is known as the lungs of Mesoamerica, includes part of the second largest rainforest in Latin America, and it is a hot spot for land grabbing. An estimated 1,000 people from the Miskito indigenous community have been driven from their land in the Basawas. Can you tell us more about this? And also, how does this land grabbing actually work?
So what you see in the Basawas Reserve, much like in the Amazon and other rainforest stories that people may be more familiar with, standing tropical rainforests are often best protected by indigenous communities who have lived there for centuries and know how to live in these areas without destroying the forests. That is also true for large parts of the Basawas Reserve and other parts of northern Nicaragua. What you see in Nicaragua is this expansion of agriculture, of cattle pastures, of mining, of all these different kinds of commerce that are gradually eating away at these rainforests and attacking, physically and violently attacking the communities that live there to claim the land. These settlers are called colonos by the indigenous communities in the area, and they will sometimes literally have armed groups of colonos who come into a rainforest zone, will attack anyone who stands in their way, and essentially take the area over for the purpose of either cattle pastures, raising agriculture, or some other kind of commercial venture, which allows them to make more money. You know, there's not a lot of money in our current system for standing rainforests, and it creates this very dangerous incentive for people who are willing to seize and steal land that doesn't belong to them.
You also write about mining, and where there's mining, there's land grabbing, and it's often violent. You all report that 6 indigenous people were killed in just 48 hours in one municipality last year, 3 of them murdered by settlers claiming new territory. And this is a so-called mining triangle in the remote North Caribbean coast autonomous region?
Yeah, so the mining triangle is an area in northern Nicaragua where they've discovered gold. They've discovered several other natural resources that are very valuable. And there are big mining companies, including foreign mining companies, that are now operating in the region. And the government, the Ortega government, you know, even though it takes this very pro-environmental position on the international stage, at every opportunity has supported and enabled companies that are seeking to profit from developing these lands, whether it's mining companies, which not only they issued record numbers of permits in the last 5 years, but they actually even created a state-owned mining company, which can make profits from these companies by forcing foreign companies to do joint ventures with the state mining company when they begin operations. To other things like agriculture and cattle pastures, which community groups say are tacitly encouraged by the government, in part by its refusal to enforce the law and do anything about violent attacks by settlers against indigenous communities.
So when you looked at the companies that are involved in all of this, are most of them involved with Ortega's regime? I mean, do most of them have to go through Ortega's regime and his inner circle, or can they also do it outside of that circle?
I mean, what we saw in our reporting and what a number of experts and even business people operating in Nicaragua told me is that there has been a growing personal takeover of the economy by the Ortega family and by the Sandinista government, that it essentially no longer operates like a system where there's a rule of law that operates with the same regulations applying to everyone. So there are laws on the books, there are procedures on the books, there are government ministries that are charged with carrying out these procedures. But the way that things really work, people say, is that now everything runs through the first family, and everything runs through this system that they've created in order to ensure their political control over the economy, and also has been immensely profitable for them. I mean, you know, what experts have told me is that this is a textbook example of a kleptocracy, which is incredibly ironic given the revolutionary history of the Ortegas and the Sandinistas, which came to power in the 1980s, vowing to end exploitation of Nicaragua and vowing to end foreign companies' exploitation of Nicaragua. And instead, what experts have told us is you now have one family that essentially says that almost all of the economy has to run through them.
Today, we're speaking with Sasha Chavkin, an investigative reporter specializing in the environment, Latin America, and public corruption. He was the lead reporter for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project's investigation about the deforestation crisis in Nicaragua. Sasha is a Rainforest Investigations Network fellow covering deforestation for NBC News and the Pulitzer Center. And if you have a question or comment about this investigation and what these reporters found, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You know, going back to Ortega, as you all report in this piece, despite presenting itself as anti-deforestation, Ortega even refused to sign the Paris Agreement for 2 years on the basis that it didn't go far enough. The government has worked hard to promote these sectors, as you've been talking about. I mean, what is the pushback against this? Obviously, we know what is happening with the media. And then when you look at what's happening with environmental activists, Nicaragua per capita is the most dangerous place in the world to be an environmental defender. So what options do people have to speak out, to stand up against this at this point?
I mean, it's really, really hard. You know, as we've talked about, several of the journalists, including Christopher Mendoza, who we worked with on the project, are now out of the country. Some of the NGOs and community groups based in the Northern Indigenous Territory, who we spoke to for our reporting, have since been shut down in the months after our project. One of the things that we saw in this report by Global Witness that you mentioned before about killings of land and environment defenders is you see this really eerie trend where reports of killings of environment defenders are higher and higher in countries that become more and more autocratic. And then all of a sudden, the reports disappear in the most autocratic countries. So you see, you know, high numbers of killings in countries with, you know, lots of violence and weak rule of law, Mexico, Colombia, the Philippines, Nicaragua have incredibly high numbers of killings recorded. But for example, in a country like China or a country like Russia, you don't see any kinds of these reports. And what's frightening about that is it shows that governments can reach a point where they are able to silence community groups, and they're able to silence the news of their own repression of community groups and environmental groups. And that's what governments are reaching for when they crack down. That's what powerful economic actors are reaching for when they crack down. There is this place that you can get to where autocracy is able to suppress the truth about what is happening. And it was really scary to watch that kind of autocracy being imposed or being attempted to be imposed on Nicaragua in real time as we were reporting.
It's really devastating. I mean, just reading details about people who've been killed, these people are being just brutally, brutally killed. Before we let you go, Sasha, how much money is the Ortega family making off of all of this?
A lot. I don't have a figure offhand. What I do know is that there are funds, you know, worth billions of dollars that have been, for example, directed to the country through foreign aid from Venezuela in one case, which essentially are operated without transparency under the control of the first family. And, you know, a lot of what the Ortegas use money and resources for is shoring up their political power. You know, it's not like everything is going into a Swiss bank account. But I certainly wouldn't be surprised if a chunk of it is going into a Swiss bank account or a bank account in the Caribbean or something like that. And even the money that is not personally going into their pockets, to the extent that it's being used to impose their political rule through patronage or through corruption or through controlling key sectors of the economy, that has an equally damaging effect on the country and on its economic prospects going forward.
What about the international community? You all report that given all this corruption, the international community and the UN have given a lot of money to the government. The Alliance of Indigenous Peoples and Afro-Descendants of Nicaragua wrote in an open letter to the UN's Green Climate Fund after it approved a $115 million BioClima project in November that the Nicaraguan government has demonstrated it cannot protect our communal lands, our forests, or our Indigenous and Afro-Descendant population. So what explains the international money coming in?
International climate funds, you know, these are funds that are set up through the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. They're funds like the Green Climate Fund is a big one. There are a few others. And essentially, these are funds that are meant to help poor countries adapt or mitigate climate change. In some cases, specifically to protect forests and prevent deforestation. And the idea of these funds is that they're not supposed to be political. You know, even if the international community may have concerns about your government or may not like your government, the idea is that they want this money to be able to go out in order to help keep forests standing and in order to help countries meet their climate targets under international conventions. It reaches a point, though, where if you have a government that is actively enabling deforestation, where you start to wonder, should they be getting this money at all? And that's the kind of situation we have in Nicaragua, where money has continued to flow into the country from foreign organizations, even though community groups in Nicaragua are saying, hold on, the government is going to use this for the opposite of the intended purpose. There's been some pullback. For example, the World Bank last year withdrew funding for one of the projects it was planning to support. But this is a tension that exists throughout climate aid. And Nicaragua shows you one of these extreme cases where money has continued to flow in, even though there's very serious reason for concern about how it would be used.
Given that you cover deforestation, I mean, there's so much to be concerned about here, given that if this continues at current rates, Nicaragua's forests could be gone in just a few decades?
Yeah, I mean, it's what we found based on United Nations data is that Nicaragua has had the fastest rate of forest loss of any country in the world. That's based on data from 2015 to 2020. It doesn't mean that Nicaragua has been losing more forests because, you know, it's a small country compared to Brazil or Indonesia or any of the other big rainforest countries. But the pace at which its forests are being cleared is faster than anywhere else. I couldn't tell you exactly what year they would be gone based on the current rate, but the trend is quite literally the worst in the world. Again, based on Nicaragua's own reports to the United Nations about how much forest is left standing and how much forest is being lost.
Sasha Chavkin is an investigative reporter who was the lead on the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project's investigation about deforestation in Nicaragua. Sasha is a Rainforest Investigations Network fellow covering deforestation for NBC News and the Pulitzer Center. Sasha, huge thanks to you and your team for this important report. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And you can find the piece at yourcallradio.org. And then a related show that we did a couple weeks ago, we talked about The Territory. It's a new documentary about the ongoing fight to save the Amazon rainforest from land grabbers, loggers, and corporations. You can also find that show at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about California's ongoing drought and new water restrictions. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.